Case number 24-7081, Dutch Telecom AG versus Republic of India, appellant. Ms. Menaker for the appellant, Ms. Boykin for the appellate.
Good morning, counsel. Ms. Menaker, please proceed when you're ready, and I apologize if I pronounced that incorrectly.
So, good morning. May it please the court. India has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. India respectfully requests that this court reverse the district court's judgment, which took the extraordinary step of enforcing an arbitral award against a foreign sovereign without even giving that sovereign, India, an opportunity to brief its preserved merits defenses after the district court denied its sovereign immunity defenses. India has raised several issues on appeal, all of which it preserves, but today I'd like to focus on two of those issues that are primed for this court to reverse the district court's judgment. First, India did not waive its preserved merits defenses when it invoked the PNID framework. And second, when reviewing those merits defenses, there is not clear and unmistakable evidence that the court should defer to the conclusions of the arbitral tribunal. So turning to the first of those arguments, the district court committed reversible error by violating the two-step framework that this court established in the PNID versus Nigeria case, which held that a foreign state is entitled to first have its colorable assertions of immunity determined before having to defend on the merits of a claim. And guided
and
by
the difficulty for you here is that your arguments about the terms investor and investment, and they may be right or wrong as a substantive matter, but they don't seem to me colorable as an immunity matter in light of our cases.
With respect, Your Honor, as of the date when we filed our motion to dismiss, which was back in September of 2021, our immunity defenses were more than colorable at that time. And that is because up until that time, there had been ambiguity and disagreement amongst the courts as to whether our type of an immunity defense, which was that DT.
You have Stilix, which is about the term investment, and Stilix and Chevron are about investment and investor arguments in a bit going to scope.
That's right. They're both distinguishable, Your Honor. In Stilix, Moldova, that case was under the Moldova-Ukrainian BIT, and Moldova argued that the claims did not fall within the scope of the agreement to arbitrate because the investor had structured its investment through the BVI, allegedly to evade Ukrainian currency controls. And so that was more akin to an argument that we made and preserved on the merits, our fraud argument. They're arguing that the investment was made illegally, and therefore the scope of those claims did not fall within the agreement to arbitrate. In Chevron, Ecuador said again that contract claims that Chevron wanted to bring did not fall within the scope of the arbitration agreement. And in your Next Era 2 case, in fact, you distinguished Spain's arguments from the claimant's arguments that were made, excuse me, the respondent's arguments that were made in both Stilix and Moldova. And if you look at page 1103 of the Next Era 2 case, you can see there that this court says that in both Chevron and Stilix, the sovereigns argued that they hadn't agreed to arbitrate because the arbitration agreement did not extend to the disputes. So that was a scope issue. And it then characterized Spain's argument as being somewhat different because there Spain was arguing that the Energy Charter Treaty did not extend to EU nationals like the claimants there. So that was an issue as to whether the investor was a proper offeree of the offer to arbitrate in the bilateral investment treaty. And that is akin to the argument that we made before the district court. And so certainly at that time,
you agree that the through line of all those cases is that arguments about the existence of an agreement go to immunity and therefore jurisdiction. Arguments about the scope of the agreement go to the New York Convention merits defense.
Yes.
That's why this case, there's no doubt that India signed the bit with Germany, and it protects German investors with regard to investment disputes. And there's a question about, whether the investor includes the corporation one line up in the ownership chain.
But
it seems as much about scope as can be.
But I respectfully disagree, because it is about the existence of the agreement. The agreement needs to be with a party or for the benefit of a party. And here, simply by saying that you are
a German... There is an agreement. India has made an agreement with Germany to protect German investors.
But that...
And there's a question whether this corporation is a German investor.
Correct. And so there, we made an agreement for the benefit of German investors. So one necessarily has to answer the question as to whether you are a German investor that falls within the scope of that agreement, within the confines. Well, I'm using that terminology, I think, in a different manner than the other cases use it when you talk about the scope of claims, because it's very different to say that we agreed to arbitrate with German investors. And my question here, like in Chevron versus Ecuador, but we didn't agree to arbitrate contract claims. We only agreed to arbitrate treaty claims. That's a scope question. But clearly, it cannot be, for instance, that a group of German university students go over to India on vacation and one trips and falls in a hotel room and says, well, I will bring a claim under the bilateral investment treaty. This is made for the benefit of me. I'm an investor. I'm helping the Indian economy. I'm paying for hotels, cab fares, right? There has to be some limitation to determine whether there is an arbitration agreement, whether there exists an arbitration agreement. And again,
in that scenario, the way that would come up in an FSIA context in our court, it would be predicated on an arbitrator actually concluding that it's within the terms of the arbitration agreement, so that the arbitrator has jurisdiction, right? So,
yes.
I mean, I take your point that there's going to be some line drawing questions at some point that seem like under our decisions, they actually do go to the existence of the agreement rather than to its scope. But it would have to be a context in which the arbitration panel or the arbitrator, depending on what sort of procedure followed, would have concluded that the agreement actually does give that claim to them. And it would still have to be so outlandish, like the German tourists, that it would then come to us and the argument would be made, well, that actually went to jurisdiction rather than to scope.
Sure, but you would have de novo review over that. And yes, and there are arbitrator panel determinations that could be outlandish in that regard. But you would think there that the state would have the opportunity to say that they are immune, not just defend on the merits of that claim, but to say we are immune, we never agreed to arbitrate. So I'm not asking you here now to agree with me on the ultimate question of our immunity, but to look back into September 2021 and say it certainly was colorable at that time. And what shows that it was colorable.
And what happens after that is next era?
Well, what comes, it is next era. But the fact.
What is there something else? I mean, because.
No.
Okay.
No, it's next era. And the fact that this court heard next era too and was looking at two divergent, well, there were three district court decisions, as you know, but two divergent ones. So you had Nine Ren and you had Blasket. And in Blasket, the district court judge found, contrary to next era two, you reversed that decision. So clearly there, that was a colorable argument that they were making there at that time.
That decision was post-Chevron and Stilix.
That's correct.
Right.
That's correct. So that's post-Chevron, post-Stilix. And I think in next era two, the court actually looks, and the way that it's characterizing these cases, it's extending the holdings of those cases. It's an extension, because it wasn't clear prior to that time. Another example that we gave in our briefs was the case where actually Deutsche Telekom's counsel is counsel in that case for Equatorial Guinea, Marcel Klinken. where that was 3 months after we filed our motion to dismiss, and the respondent there argued that the district court's rejection of its immunity defense should be reversed because of Blaskett, right? So they were making the argument there that that was still ambiguous enough.
Can I ask a question about how you would ask us to construe the colorability standard from PNID and with respect to two sub-aspects of it? So one is, I read PNID as borrowing from Bell versus Hood, which is a pretty strict standard. I mean, it has to be so insubstantial that the claim, if it were brought in the trial court, wouldn't even support federal jurisdiction. So that's part of the question is, what do we do with that standard vis-a-vis colorability in the way you read our opinion? And then secondly, if there's panel precedents, I know you have an argument that even under the panel precedents as they existed at the time, it's still colorable because look at what happened with NextEra, look at what happened to district court, one district court. I understand that. But let's suppose the panel precedents are preclusive of that. And so let's suppose it's post-NextEra. Let's make it easy. Let's suppose it's post-NextEra. But then the argument for colorability isn't that you actually have a colorable claim under existing panel precedent. It's that there's an abstract way in which you have a colorable argument because you're not taking the panel precedent as a given because you might win in the en-banc court or might win in the Supreme Court. So what's your reaction to either or both of those?
Well, I agree with your suggestions on both, which is first, it's a very low standard or a very low hurdle for us to get over to show colorability. And in a slightly different context, I've seen it as a hint of a suggestion. And if you look at PNID itself, that was a decision of 2020 of this court. And this court said that you reversed and said that the district court had to hear the immunity arguments that Nigeria was making before its merits arguments. That immunity argument that Nigeria was making in that case was the arbitral seat was in London, and a Nigerian court had taken jurisdiction and vacated or set aside the award. And Nigeria was arguing that as an issue of immunity, saying, well, our award has been set aside, not by the court of the seat, but has been set aside, and therefore no award exists and we're immune. And this court found that that was a colorable enough assertion to go back. And what's interesting is if you look at the 2022 decision, because that case went up and down the courts a bit, of PNID, the court here rejects the immunity or upholds the rejection of the immunity claim and finds that it's precluded by 2016 precedent of the court, finding that when an award has been set aside, if you're using that as an objection or a defense, that that is a merits defense only under the New York Convention. It doesn't implicate immunity. So in 2020, when this court said that Nigeria had the right to have its immunity questions heard before the merits, you already had a 2016 precedent that you said foreclosed the merits of that defense, and yet it was still colorable and it still entitled them to have that heard. So
is it your position as well that India has had no prior opportunity to present these defenses?
India, that is correct, because on the two immunity defenses that we did raise, no U.S. court has reviewed those defenses because the district court found that they weren't immunity defenses. It then said they would consider them as New York Convention defenses. However, it said that it deemed the parties to clearly and unmistakably delegate the authority for deciding those defenses to the arbitral tribunal, and it had no authority to second guess those determinations. So no one has looked at that. And then with our preserved defenses, no U.S. court has considered those either. And we
those arguments would be considered elsewhere, right? And it haven't been met with
only some of them
from your perspective.
Some of them. So there are two. One is fraud. One is the essential security interest. Deutsche Telekom acknowledges that neither the arbitral tribunal nor the Swiss court had made any determinations on fraud given the timing of those allegations. With the essential security interest, the arbitral tribunal and the court had looked at that, But again, that has no bearing on the United States' court's ability to review those determinations. And we contend that the review of those determinations should be an independent review. They ought not to defer to the arbitral tribunal's determinations because there simply is no clear and unmistakable evidence that the parties agreed to delegate to the tribunal the authority to make that determination. The district court relied on dicta in some cases of this court, the Stilex and I believe the Stilex case, when it held that because the bid incorporated or referenced the UNCITRAL.
You're losing me with the
chain. Sorry.
Are we talking about the investor investment arguments that might you want to make into immunity, but if they're not immunity, they're substantive New York Convention defenses, or are we talking about the other ones?
I was talking about both.
Okay.
Because the ones that we have not had a chance to brief yet and that we preserved, of course, we want those heard as New York Convention cases. We had, and to clear up any misconception, we had no intention of getting a second bite of the apple on our immunity defenses. So if they had been heard as immunity defenses, we would not then have re-raised them under the New York Convention. It would not have made sense. They would have been determined. They have not been heard, though. So if we went back, we would want to raise them under the New York Convention. Of course, we'd want...
So as to those defenses, the investor and investment, but not the other two.
Yes.
We just... Then we come to the question whether the district court... So he says no immunity, but he goes on to resolve them as New York Convention defenses. And he says... It's not for me to decide because those defenses were delegated to the arbitrator.
Correct. So that's what he said, although we say that is incorrect because we didn't delegate those to the arbitrator, nor did we delegate our preserved merits defenses to the arbitrator. The only thing that the district judge looked at was the fact that the UNCITRAL rules governed the arbitration, and those rules contain a standard competence clause. There is no clear and unmistakable evidence, and that's, of course, the standard under first options, that the parties to this dispute, to the bit, which is to be interpreted as a contract, that they intended to delegate exclusive authority to the arbitrators to determine these issues. And if you look at BG versus Argentina, in the U.S. Supreme Court, the court there says very clearly that ultimately interpreting a treaty is like interpreting a contract, and what is important is the intentions of the parties. And here we have two things that I think are of utmost importance. One is
Argentina, counsel. This court was reversed in BG versus Argentina because the Supreme Court said to us all of these questions, regardless of the facts, sovereigns are involved, are to be decided by the arbitrator.
Yes. Yes, no, and that's...
I take that as very strong language from the Supreme Court.
Yes, but what the Supreme Court said when it had made that determination, it said that what you need to do to determine if it is to be resolved by the arbitrators is to look at the contracting party's intent. And so that's what I want to look at here. And here, the contracting parties to the treaty are India and Germany. And there can be no doubt that India and Germany understand the UNCITRAL rules and Article 21 in particular to afford the arbitral tribunal an initial determination of these issues to be later reviewed by a court. And that is absolutely, Deutsche Telekom doesn't contest that. That is their understanding of those clauses. And when you look at our bit in particular in Article 9.2b5, it says that the award shall be enforced in accordance with the national laws of the contracting party where the investment has been made. That's Indian law. So, and we have other arguments, of course, that we construe that choice of law clause as being a forum selection clause, but even at its most narrow as a choice of law clause, that means that in enforcing this award, we have to apply Indian law. There is no doubt that Indian law interprets the UNCITRAL rule as simply giving the...
So can I just ask a question about where this fits in the overall architecture of what we have before us? So you took a collateral order appeal from the denial of dismissal on jurisdictional grounds, right?
I think not. I think we waited until final judgment was entered. It was a few weeks later.
Oh, okay. True. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So, but then what do we have before us? Because we clearly have the jurisdictional question before us. And then if we suppose we disagree with you on jurisdiction, so that we assume that the questions that you think are jurisdictional ones actually go to scope. Let's just suppose that. I know you resist that, but let's just suppose that. If that's true, then we also have before us what the district court did to go on and decide the merits of those two, of that question, as opposed to the ones that are just bracketed off and never addressed by the district court because the district court said that those are effectively waived or forfeited by you. So on, if we go on to the UNCITRAL question, the question of does the provision in the UNCITRAL that deals with what the arbitrator has jurisdiction to do, we address that one as well.
Yes.
In this appeal. If we get past your jurisdiction.
I believe so, because the court, if you go back and say that it was error to deny our, you can either deny our foreign sovereign immunity defenses, or you can say, well, they were denied, they should have been scope. However, you should not have then said that we waived our ability to bring the merits defenses. And then since the court in its order has already said that it finds itself bound by the arbitral tribunal's determination of those and wasn't able to second guess, I believe that that is then before you now, and we're asking you to reverse on that. That is a de novo determination, whether there was clear and unmistakable evidence that we intended to delegate this question to the arbitrators. And so if you reversed on that, then saying there was no clear and unmistakable evidence of delegation, then it would be remanded, vacated or remanded, and we would have heard our New York Convention defenses under an independent review standard.
The Indian law that you cite as invoking a model that the arbitrator gets to decide arbitrability questions in the first instance, then subject to judicial review. Is that specific to UNCITRAL or just general, like India's version of BG, just this is how presumptively how things work?
I would need to double check, but I believe it does contain some case law that would have dealt with UNCITRAL because India, for instance, is not a party to the ICSID convention.
So they go under UNCITRAL and not ICSID.
Exactly.
So, and, I guess the reason I ask is we have cases, you know, the same cases I was citing at you earlier, those cases say that invoking a provision in the contract which calls for application of UNCITRAL rules, which permit the arbitrator to decide questions of arbitrability, is sufficient to assign those questions exclusively to the arbitrator.
Sure. And I just have a few responses to that. But first of all, those cases are looking, again, what you need to do in each of the cases is just not to say that there are the UNCITRAL rules which are being referenced, but you have to look at the intent of the parties. And so the court presumably did or should have looked to the intention of the parties in those cases to those particular bits to determine if there was clear and unmistakable evidence. And that's what we're asking this court to do here, is to not have any flatline rule. We need to look to the intention of these parties. And there's just no way that India and Germany intended to delegate exclusive authority to the arbitrators when in because our submission
the background law
because the background, so law the background law and
you can't follow.
No, go ahead. I mean what's odd about this is if you were thinking about the world from first principles, you might think only the judges can decide these questions, or only the arbitrators can decide these questions, or door number three, the arbitrators decide in the first instance and the judges review, which you say is Indian law. And yet, you know, BG says your options are door number one or door number two. And I don't know what to make of that. I mean, you know, tend to think I'm bound by Supreme Court precedent, but is that just no one in any of these cases is thinking that a contract might provide for door number three? Is that what's going on?
Well, I think that the U.S. is somewhat unique in this regard, because I don't know of any other jurisdiction that does interpret these provisions in the manner that the U.S. courts have done on occasion. But
because
again,
our non-FSIA FAA law is so arbitration friendly.
I don't know why it is.
Okay.
I think that, but I also think that BG in Argentina, and not to just repeat myself, but there first it was looking at a different issue. It was looking at a procedural time issue. But the court did emphasize that what you need to look is for clear and unmistakable evidence, and you need to look at the party's intent. And I'd also just point the court's attention to a statement in DT's opposition that we have quoted, where they say that, and I quote, this is at 21, through the incorporation of the UNCITRAL rules, India agreed to, quote, to delegate disputes about arbitrability to the arbitrators, subject only to post-award judicial review. That's what we're asking for, is post-award judicial review.
Yeah, I'm not, the thing about that is that may well be the background principle in Indian law. I'm not sure that that's not the background principle all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we still have these decisions that treat the UNCITRAL provision and the parallel one under ICSID as not only creating a regime in which the arbitrator gets the first crack, subject to judicial review, but it's creating a regime in which the arbitrator gets the first and last crack.
Well, I think
that just seems like that's, I mean, this competence idea is not some, you know, unique principle that applies in the narrow corner of the universe. It seems like it's a pretty universal one abroad, but yet we still have our decisional law still says that these particular provisions, I think it's basically parallel between UNCITRAL and ICSID, that what they do is that they give it to the arbitrator in the first instance, and that's exclusive of subsequent judicial review.
Well, I would disagree with that, because there is a very material distinction between UNCITRAL and ICSID insofar as ICSID has a two-tier layer of review. It's an independent review. So after you have your arbitral award, if you want to review that under essentially the same standards as the New York Convention, I mean, slightly different, but it's ICSID Article 54. It's deferential, but what you do is you don't go to court to do that. You have a second tribunal. It's called an ad hoc committee within the arbitral process. So you have two, and then when you go to court, it's a much more summary procedure. So I don't think it can be compared, because of course you're deferring to the tribunal or the ad hoc committee. You've already had your level of review, whereas here with UNCITRAL, you haven't. And I would just also point the court's attention to the DTK versus hotels case, which was before the Second Circuit in 2021, when we're talking about these arbitral rules automatically meaning that you delegate to the arbitrators an exclusive determination. The Second Circuit cast that into doubt when it said you have to look at the particular circumstances, which is what we're saying here. There, it was an arbitration clause an agreement governed by the AAA. There was a AAA arbitration, and yet there was a question as to whether the clause covered the scope of dispute that was being dealt with. And the Second Circuit said, we find it ambiguous. It's an argument. Maybe it's covered, maybe it's not. So we're finding that it's not clear and unmistakable evidence that you delegated this to the tribunal, and we're going to look at it ourselves. So even there, when the AAA, I think, is clear, when you look at the history, the legislative or statutory history, when those rules were promulgated, that they had first options in mind and they wanted to make this delegation. That's not the case for the 1976 Sanchez trial rules for certain, but even in a case governed by the AAA rules, the Second Circuit saw that there could be exceptions based on the particularities of that case. And that's what we contend should happen here, particularly also, I would also note, with both Chevron and Stilex, which contain the language about the Sanchez trial rules delegation, I note that the parties in those cases did not brief and argue that issue. So in that respect, the court didn't have the full ability or the full opportunity to hear argument on that. And to the extent that they just accepted or acknowledged that point and were happy with that standard of review, we don't think that that should bind us going forward. And in that sense, we have called that dicta.
Okay. You have authority for the judicial review model under Indian law. Do you know what would be the standard of review? The cases don't seem to speak to it. Is it de novo review on arbitrability? Is it review for reasonableness? Is it review under the U.S., you know, super deferential? Does this
derive
from the essence of the contract standard? What is the level of scrutiny?
I understand the question. I don't know the answer. And I apologize. I can get back to the court on that if you would like.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll give you a little time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the other side now. Mr. Boykin.
Thank you, Your Honor. James Boykin on behalf of Deutsche Telekom, petitioner and appellee. I will first address the argument that the second issue on appeal as to whether the district court erred in not giving India a second round of briefing. That's foreclosed by their own conduct. PNID gives a state an absolute right to invoke immunity defenses, but it also recognizes the inherent right of the sovereign to choose to raise immunity defenses together with merits defenses, with, however, the consequence that it would, in so doing, it foregoes the right to have the immunity determination made as a threshold matter. In this case, India did not raise any colorable argument of immunity. But even if one were to look inside and their motion to dismiss and find a colorable argument of immunity, one cannot overlook the fact that India raised merits defenses. And those merits defenses were specifically that there was no investment and there was no investor. Now, India tries to say this was colorable at the time and was cleared up by NextEra. That is not correct. And they
but
do
when you're
so
saying those are merits issues, that India was presenting them as jurisdictional arguments, right?
Right. But this court's clear precedent at the time in Chevron and Stilex held that these do not go to jurisdiction or immunity.
Okay, so then that goes to whether they're colorable jurisdictional arguments, not whether they're merits arguments. And
we say so, they're merits arguments.
No, but no, I think the question is, maybe I'm misunderstanding the architecture here, but I thought those are being presented as jurisdictional arguments. You disagree that they're jurisdictional arguments. You may, let's just suppose you're right about that, but that doesn't answer the question of whether they're colorable jurisdictional arguments. And if they're colorable jurisdictional arguments, India did not then need to go on and make merits arguments. At that point, they could have reserved their opportunity to make other merits arguments.
Fair enough. In that framework, I would say they're not colorable because Chevron and Stilex have already held that those defenses are not immunity arguments. They go to.
So what about the point that as to that, what about the point that even NextEra hadn't been decided?
Right.
So we're in a Chevron Stilex land, Stilex land.
Yep.
There was a district court decision, as counsel pointed out, that the district courts went two different ways and on the NextEra question. So was that district court decision that went a way opposite of the way we saw NextEra, did they get it so wrong that actually it doesn't even meet the Bell v. Hood standard for whether it's a substantial argument?
But NextEra didn't decide any question that was relevant to this case when their motion to dismiss was filed. And India's own brief, or the reply brief on page 6, acknowledges that NextEra really concerned Spain's legal capacity to arbitrate. It had to do with a question of EU law and whether Spain could have the legal capacity to arbitrate with persons within the EU. The questions that they framed in front of the district court in the motion to dismiss in this case were clearly covered by Stilex and Chevron. On their motion to dismiss, page 27, they complained that the supposed investment under the agreement was indirect. In page 26, they talk about DT's status as an investor. And there's nothing about Germany's capacity to have entered into the agreement with India. There's no allegation that the treaty was never ratified, which would go to the existence.
It has to not even be colorable, including on the direct indirect one. And just to tease out what exactly the colorability threshold entails, suppose you have a situation in which the panel precedents that you're relying on, and again, we're in a pre-NextEra stage.
Yeah.
Suppose you have a situation in which the panel precedents that you say make a claim non-colorable under those precedents included a dissent. Then would you say that the argument is just non-colorable because the panel precedents say they don't go forward, even if there's a panel dissent, and the case has never gone before the en banc, the issue has never gone before the en banc court, much less the Supreme Court?
Yes. If it's controlling precedent, it's not colorable. And I think
if there's a dissent and it's never gone before the en banc court and it's never gone before the Supreme Court.
I think there's precedent in this circuit that it's bound to apply a panel decision.
There's no doubt we're bound by it. I think there's at least a subsequent panel would be bound by it.
Right.
I guess my question is.
Oh, your question. Is it colorable in that context?
Right.
Right. But the question. These questions of investment have been settled with Chevron, Stilex. And but NextEra did something.
Were they so settled that it, were they so obviously wrong that it's not even colorable? I know that there's panel precedents that you say make them wrong. The question is whether they're not even colorable.
In our view, if they're foreclosed by clear circuit precedent that's been consistently applied, then they're not colored immunity defenses. Because the otherwise, the result is going to be that every state will come and reassert merits defenses as immunity defenses and to claim they're entitled to the two-step process. And this circuit court can say over and over again, those are actually go to the merits. And it must be the case.
Well, there's definitely a colorability threshold. And so you're right that at some point something becomes non-colorable. I guess the question is, how strict is that standard?
It's pretty low. It's in PNID. It has to be plausible. But our position is that once it's foreclosed by a
one can imagine lots of cases where there's binding circuit precedent and a plausible opportunity for in bank or cert. It's like they take the appeal and say they seek initial in bank.
And well, that would
not
be
for you. Dissent.
Right. But if you read NextEra, it decides something new that is not relevant to this case, but it very heavily relies on Chevron and Stilex. And there's no indication that Chevron and Stilex are set up for en banc review or that there's questions about their authority. In fact, this court just relied on them in, as my colleague pointed out, a number of consolidated cases concerning the EU dispute and Spain's authority and power to arbitrate. And district courts reached divergent results on that because it involved a sovereign saying we are constrained by EU law. That was a novel question. That was a colorable argument of immunity. But Chevron and Stilex, on which NextEra relied, those are settled. So these arguments weren't colorable under the very low threshold. I think there's also they knew they weren't colorable. And one other indication of the lack of colorability of the argument is that in these briefs, it's framed as our proper offeree argument. And in their first, they filed on June 24th, a statement of issues that the district court erred in holding that the arbitration exception applied. In their brief and their statement of issues, they say the district court erred in not giving de novo review to a proper offeree defense. But they never made a proper offeree defense to the district court. They don't use those words in their motion to dismiss. Those were proper offeree defense wasn't even in the statement of issues after they filed appeal. That those words emerge and they encapsulate investor and investment. They emerge after NextEra. So what they're doing is essentially rewriting the motion to dismiss to make it look like it was something akin to that what was undecided in NextEra. But it's not. There was never first, never a proper offeree defense argued to the district court. So it's hard to criticize the district court for not having ruled on an issue not put before it. And second, what is a proper offeree under the bid?
Can I ask a question about the incentive dynamics that would be at play if we construe colorability in the way that you are, because in the way that I think your argument suggests, because I take it that what would end up happening is that a foreign sovereign, because they'd be worried that the jurisdictional arguments they made may be seen to be non-colorable under panel circuit precedent, would feel like they need to make every merits argument that they have in their initial pleading. So you could have a threshold jurisdictional argument and then you have 27 merits arguments that follow it, all of which are going to be briefed by a foreign sovereign. Then the district court understandably would say, I don't want to deal with all these merits arguments because I think there's no jurisdiction here. And then we'd be in a situation in which that all could have been resolved at the jurisdictional stage, but then the foreign sovereign would, because of concerns about being deemed to have waived merits arguments, would have felt the need to develop and introduce that kind of array of merits arguments.
The foreign sovereign need not have such a concern under P and ID, which expressly recognizes its right to a two-step process when it raises colorable immunity arguments.
Right, but it just places all the load-bearing weight on whether it's colorable. And I guess what I'm saying is, if we don't have a very, very low threshold for what's colorable, then a foreign sovereign who's going to be careful just can't risk it. You got to include all your merits arguments because I could be seen to, for example, in this case, even if there's not, NextEra hasn't come along yet, maybe Chevron and Stilex say that this is non-colorable, and therefore I'm just going to end. And India happens to have a couple more merits arguments. I'm sure there's other cases in which a foreign sovereign has many, many more merits arguments than that, but they would feel compelled at the threshold to include all of those. And I just wonder whether that's a healthy incentive dynamic.
Well, I mean, the foreign sovereign has the incentive to raise all of its colorable immunity arguments in its first brief. Mm-hmm. And it has the right to choose to raise merits arguments at the same time or not. So it cannot waive merits arguments if it raises only colorable immunity arguments. And so the policy and administrative angle that your question was approaching is better served by sending a message that if you're going to invoke the two-step process, pay attention to this circuit's precedent about what is an immunity objection and what is not. And that's a reason that's still a low standard of colorability. A colorable argument, we admit, should have a low standard. But to have a decision that requires sovereigns to look at controlling precedent of the circuit as to where that line has been drawn.
Suppose you have a situation in which the circuit in which you are is an outlier. So you have panel precedent that, let's just say, clearly forecloses an argument. But then every other court of appeals, there's eight other courts of appeals that are pronounced on the question and disagree. Would you say that the argument is non-colorable and therefore all the merits arguments have to be included because in this circuit, the law points in a particular discretion? And it's clear in this circuit, and it's only panel precedents, the panel precedents point.
No, if there was, I would say it's colorable immunity. And I've never said they have to include merits arguments with a colorable immunity. A sovereign has a right to make that choice. A sovereign has a right, though, to a threshold determination of immunity. So if you had eight other circuits, that would be colorable. But once the sovereign brings in what are clearly merits defenses, it has waived its right to a second round of briefing. That's the only conclusion for which we're advocating, that they've essentially briefed all of their merits defenses, and the judge was entitled to rule on them. And this gets us into sort of the judge was entitled or obligated under the law because of the Uncitral rules and that the parties delegated the intent to decide issues of arbitrability to the arbitrators. And my colleague said that the judge did not consider the intent. The district court looked at the Uncitral rules. He construed the treaty as a contract, and he considered their extrinsic evidence. And he said, even if it were proper for me to consider that extrinsic evidence, it doesn't override the language in the contract that has the Uncitral rules and the delegation. And as for the background law of India requiring de novo review, they did get de novo review of the arbitrator's decision by the Swiss Federal Supreme Court. And there's no proposition of law that requires a court of secondary jurisdiction like this, like a district court sitting as a court of secondary jurisdiction in a convention case, to follow Indian law. Rather, it has to follow the Supreme Court and look to the fact that the Uncitral rules delegated these questions to the arbitrators. And on page 25 of our brief, we cite a number of cases that require the district court to defer to the judgment of the seat of the court of primary jurisdiction that scrutinized the award, and especially if they vacate the award. Well, if the court at the seat confirms an award, it should be at least entitled to the same degree of deference as when it vacates. And that's what happened here. All of these issues have been aired and ruled upon.
The district court's rationale on the merits, looking past immunity to the merits, was that arbitrability was assigned to the arbitrator through the incorporation of Uncitral. Yeah. And for that reason, the district court couldn't review the decision. And that's different from the alternative that you just floated, which is the district court can't or shouldn't review arbitrability because a Swiss court has decided.
Yes, that's different. Those are two distinct lines.
They're two distinct. Like the second one raises all sorts of questions about the issue preclusive effect of foreign judgments, which the district court didn't get into, potentially messy. I would think that one is a little uncomfortable as an alternative.
And you need not reach it because the district court was.
Let's go back to.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. So that takes us back to is the issue off the table by virtue of incorporation of Uncitral rules? And you have precedent, you have some good precedent, no doubt. But this contract seems to provide for Indian enforcement law to govern enforcement questions. And if it is the case that Indian enforcement law has this model that arbitrators decide arbitrability questions and then there's judicial review, why don't we follow Indian law per the contract?
I would say they did get the judicial review that when they agreed, Deutsche Telekom and India agreed on the seat of arbitration in Switzerland, where the law is that the Swiss Federal Supreme Court reviews questions of arbitrability de novo. They don't have a first options. And this court, we disagree with their contractual interpretation, that's in the brief, but this court, the Indian law does not so clearly override the evidence of intent. And Judge Leon at the district court level took it into account. He referred to it as extrinsic evidence, and he said it didn't override. And that's a factual finding that you would need to find was clear error, and then there was a lack of intent to refer questions of arbitrability to the arbitrators, because he did look at India's evidence and said, even if I were allowed to take in all of this extrinsic evidence, it doesn't outweigh the
unsure. I'm not sure why it's extrinsic evidence. We're construing the bit, and one provision incorporates Sansutrel, which cuts in your favor. The other provision says apply Indian enforcement law, which cuts in their favor, and this is an interpretive dispute about.
So let's look at the bit and what it says, because it doesn't say apply Indian law to enforcement. But maybe you have a clause in mind.
Arbitration shall be enforced in accordance with national laws of the party where the investment is made.
Right.
India. And like their argument that enforcement can only happen in India, I completely disagree with. But their narrower argument that Indian enforcement law governs enforcement wherever enforcement happens seems, I don't want to confuse things, but seems at least colorable.
Well, it was, first of all, it was waived because it was never made to the district court, and all they raised in front of the district court were merits defenses. So, second, in our opposition to their motion to dismiss, and I don't have the page references in my head, but we explained what this clause means. It may also be in our reply, but there are authorities that explain that this is a guarantee that states will not change their laws when it comes to enforcement. So
you say it is uniquely addressed to India and prohibits India from imposing distinct enforcement. Like they can apply their generally applicable law of arbitral enforcement.
Right.
They can't target this.
Exactly. There's,
it reads more broadly, though. Just as the award shall be enforced in accordance with the national laws of India.
Where the investment has been made.
Right. Which here is India.
Right. And it was in the opposition to the motion to dismiss. There are authorities that look at provisions similar to this that say that this type of phrase, what it means is that a state is promising not to change its laws to make enforcement more difficult. It cannot be that Germany and India have the power in a treaty to impose upon a United States district court acting as a court of secondary jurisdiction a standard of review. That court must comply with the laws of the United States. And I
understand why you say that, and
the word shall be enforced. In accordance with laws, let's assume Indian law does require de novo review. They obtained de novo review at the Swiss Federal Supreme Court. We sought confirmation and recognition. That's not enforcement.
Suppose that the agreement actually forecast everything that's come to pass. And suppose that the agreement, the provision actually spoke clearly to this and just said, the arbitrator's determination shall not be final, and a court of judicial review in any other country shall, of course, under the principle of competence that spell it out, shall have authority to review that determination. Then are you saying that that wouldn't be operative here?
I think it would be, a court could choose. I mean, two sovereign states cannot contract and affect a court's jurisdiction. Two other foreign sovereign states, no more than two private contracting parties.
No, but on the question of whether the arbitrator's determination is final and conclusive and can't be reviewed by another court, by a court.
If it said it's not final and conclusive, then it probably wouldn't be a convention award. Because a convention, I think you have to have a final award to, or it couldn't fit under the FAA is not final and binding.
It's final, conclusively resolved by the arbitrator and then subject to judicial review.
De novo.
I mean, it might be de novo or it might be for reason.
Regardless of the standard, I mean, I think because what the district court said, and understandably in light of the language in some decisions said, is that because the on-central provision provides for the arbitrator to decide arbitrability,
right,
then the incorporation of that provision means that not only the arbitrator gets to decide it, but that the arbitrator's decision of it is conclusive of any judicial review. And all I'm saying is, suppose you have a contract that just says, no, under this agreement isn't intended to do that. What this agreement is intended to do is to preserve judicial review.
Right. If you had a contract that said, no, we intend to preserve judicial review of issues of arbitrability, then there would not have been an intent to delegate those issues.
Because I thought some of the arguments you were making was that a U.S. court would never have the ability to give effect to such a provision.
I had understood your question to mean more, to be broader than on arbitrability, because the presumption is that courts review arbitrability and first options is an exception. What you're saying here and was getting at that the law of India, two contracting parties cannot expand the scope of the federal court's authority, but they can, of course, if it's evidence of intent on the question of arbitrability, that needs to be taken into account. But
let me try it this way.
Okay.
Do private parties have the power to contract for an arbitration scheme where the arbitrator decides arbitrability in the first instance and then enforcement courts review those decisions?
Yes.
Okay, so then we're just talking about whether this clause
overrides the reference to the UNCITRAL.
Accomplishes that,
right,
notwithstanding the reference to
UNCITRAL. Right, and the district court found that it did not. And I think
I don't know that the district court found that it did not. I think the district court opted under the language of some of our decisions.
Right.
The mere incorporation of the UNCITRAL means that
everything's off the table.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I'll quote from the district court at page 8. It says, while India purports to offer extra contractual evidence, and just kind of, I take your point, that would be contractual evidence, so I'm not relying on that. But he did consider this language part of it. He says, even assuming it would be proper to consider, it's sufficient to overcome the clear and unmistakable evidence found in the BITS incorporation of the UNCITRAL rules here.
But it's just the incorporation of the UNCITRAL rules. He thought, and I'm not saying that there's not support for that proposition. There is. But he just thought that that was the end of the matter.
He thought that that clause wasn't enough to override the clear and unmistakable evidence found in the BITS incorporation of the UNCITRAL rules. So, he did consider it. He didn't ignore it. We agree with him that second sentence isn't sufficient to override the reference to the UNCITRAL rules. And we have other evidence of the party's intent is when they chose Switzerland. And they got de novo review of all these issues in Switzerland. And this court, the district court, is simply applying U.S. procedural law. What does U.S. law require me to do when I'm sitting as a court of secondary jurisdiction? I defer to the arbitrators, and I'm going to go back to our cases on page 25. There are, and I'm not invoking these as res judicata, but simply there is a public policy in the United States of recognizing arbitration awards, and there's a consistent line of cases that say we give significance to the court, to rulings of the court at the seat in terms of vacature. Our point is confirmation is at least is worthy of the same dignity as if a court had vacated.
Did the Swiss court err in reviewing the arbitrability questions de novo?
No, that's Swiss law. That's well-established Swiss law that was known when the parties chose Switzerland as the seat of arbitration.
So then this whole question comes down to the difference between the law of the seat of the arbitration and the law of a secondary enforcement court. It's not, it doesn't come down to the line between arbitrators and courts.
That's right.
The district court seemed to think.
Right. And the law in Germany required de novo review.
Go ahead. Sorry, counsel. Continue.
No, I apologize. Your question is more important.
Well, I think the judge would like to hear your answer.
Okay. Well,
I'm sorry.
Okay. The law in Germany required de novo review of these questions. And the Common Gerich considered investor and investment and found and agreed with the Swiss Federal Court and the Arbitral Tribunal. The law in Singapore required de novo review.
So if that's true, then this sentence read in light of those, you have to read this sentence to mean arbitrator decides arbitrability, Swiss court gets to review those questions de novo, but no other enforcement court can.
Right. And
where does that does not come from BG or Chevron or any of those cases. It sounds plausible. I'm just not sure where it comes from.
I was about to suggest that I think, at least this is just my opinion, that a lot of American courts are uncomfortable with arbitration. All right. And that what was contemplated was that these sovereigns who have a lot of experience, a lot of legal talent available to them, make these decisions to arbitrate because of the incredible financial awards. And the only way they get these awards is not to have these matters bogged down for 20 years in the Indian courts or elsewhere. So now we have two sovereigns. They enter into an agreement to arbitrate. They've chosen the court that they want to review any questions. They've been there not once, they've been there twice. And the Swiss court has ruled. And so now what's left for what we're calling the court of secondary jurisdiction? And this court has issued a lot of very strong opinions saying we're out of it, basically. And we've fooled around with what does arbitrability mean? How broad is that term to be interpreted? And maybe we're going to switch to a different arbitration system than was described in BG versus Argentina and subsequently by the Supreme Court. But that's what's so troubling, that this is not the normal way that things go. And what, we don't trust sovereigns to make these decisions in their own interest? And therefore, this enforcement role of the secondary court is very limited. We don't start all over again. Now, maybe all that's going to change. And we'll see what position the Justice Department starts taking in these cases. But that's why it's very troubling to me that we've had all these proceedings, been twice to the court that the parties chose. And now, basically what I read the district court as saying is that the DC Circuit has made it very clear what its position is on a lot of these issues. And basically there's a very limited role for the enforcement court. It has to find three things. If it finds those three things, its role is done, other than issuing the orders and moving forth on, you know, even the award goes back overseas in this case. So that's what's troubling to me here. And if we're going to rewrite this whole scheme, fine. But we have to be clear that is what we are doing.
Your Honor effectively encapsulated our position. There's no proposition for de novo review by every court where recognition, confirmation and recognition are sought. It's free. States are free.
You heard counsel for India say, though, that they had not had the opportunity to raise these merit defenses. And your response is, well, they raised some. And the law is you get a chance to raise merits defenses, and those you don't raise, you forfeit. And that's what happened here. And
that's
there's
right.
A comfortable feeling about immunity that necessarily our court has. And that's what I hear coming up in all these questions. Maybe I misunderstand my colleagues' concerns, but that's just one view. And so what's your best answer to satisfy what I'm identifying as a level of discomfort here with the system that the Supreme Court has endorsed, that Congress has endorsed in several actions, and now this court has repeatedly endorsed?
That if such a level of discomfort exists, this is the wrong case to address it. India has litigated all of its objections before the arbitral tribunal, before the Swiss Federal Supreme Court. They were briefed before this court. They went before the district's court and asked for a stay to go back to Switzerland with, you know, supposedly evidence that would result in vacature and what would render in the district court, they said, could render it moot. He let them go, stay for a year. Swiss Federal Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to vacate. Those are the same facts about illegality that you knew during the arbitration. And they found you waived. They tried the same argument, the Singapore Commercial Court, all of these same arguments. Justice Reyes writes a wonderful decision analyzing each of them de novo. The Singapore Court of Appeals analyzed all of these questions. They have had five opportunities.
Let me just ask one last question, which is just to make sure I'm understanding your arguments about waiving merits issues. If we think that the arguments that India presented as jurisdictional arguments are colorable jurisdiction arguments, but we agree with you that they actually ultimately don't go to jurisdiction, they go to scope. But let's suppose we think that they're colorable. Then you don't say that if that's true, India waived its ability to present the merits arguments that aren't wrapped up in jurisdiction at all, that the district court just didn't pronounce on at all.
If they raised arguments on the merits together with colorable arguments of immunity, the essential security question they invoked in their motion to dismiss, that was a merits question at the arbitration. That wasn't jurisdictional. They raised questions of, you have to read their motion to dismiss and find it only raises questions of immunity, colorable questions of immunity. And we say it does not. Investor and investment, that's Chevron and Stilex, but there was also, and there's pages devoted to briefing allegations of illegal conduct, and yes, they reserve the right.
I'm just talking about the merits arguments that the district court did touch on.
Right.
What the district court said is, enough is enough. I'm not going to look at those merits arguments at all. You should have flagged them, but you should have briefed them, but you didn't at all. Those merits arguments. As to those, if we disagree with you on whether the jurisdictional arguments that did raise were colorable, so that we think they were colorable, then I'm not aware of any reason that somehow they waived the merits arguments that the district court didn't touch on at all. But maybe I'm missing something.
If you find that they only raised colorable immunity objections, then the PNID two-step process must apply. And our position is there is nothing in their brief. Investor and investment were just the two we showcased, but the brief, I mean, in the indirect nature of the investment. We feel that it's replete with what are obviously not jurisdictional, and they shouldn't be afforded another second round of briefing on these questions. And as an equitable matter, they've had more than five days and opportunities on these issues.
Just to be sure I understand all the bidding, we've been talking about a lot of different judgments. The Swiss court on direct review or confirmation in the seat of the arbitration, they reviewed arbitrability de novo.
Yes.
The Singapore court treated the Swiss court's determination of arbitrability as issue preclusive, correct? My understanding.
It may be. On some issues, okay. It did its own. And
I thought that more importantly, the Berlin court reviewed arbitrability de novo.
Yes.
Was that court wrong?
No, that's what German law requires that court to do.
So the Swiss court can review arbitrability de novo, and the German court can review arbitrability de novo.
Well, yes, and in front of the German court, it was a question of Article 5.1c under the New York Convention. Was this within the scope of the agreement to arbitrate? It was a merits defense under the convention, and they are entitled to review that question de novo because it was presented as a merits defense. They of course looked at the Swiss Federal Supreme Court. They don't think the German court gave it claim preclusive effect. It analyzed the questions, analyzed the defense, and that was the framework in Singapore. It was always presented as an Article 5.1c defense. That's what Chevron and Stilex told us. That's how my colleague, Mr. Howland, in the case, that my learned colleague referred to of Marseille Clinken, presented the argument that a 5.1c defense outside the scope, which necessarily brought back an issue of immunity. But here they raised an immunity objection. They're relying on PNID to say all we did raised were colorable immunity arguments so that they get another round of briefing, and that's what we take issue with.
Well, the other argument, surely, that they make is that after things had proceeded, they discovered an investor and a company was threatening India's national security, so it wanted to act. And surely arbitration doesn't force you to continue in an agreement where your national security is at risk.
And arbitral tribunal found that was a pretext to expropriate the commercial lease, which India then subsequently leased out to a competitor. So if its national security was at stake, presumably, India wouldn't have continued to use the S-band for commercial purposes. But those were issues decided by the arbitrators in the arbitration and the basis for the award of compensation.
And did they get the opportunity to have that reviewed de novo?
They raised it before the Swiss Federal Supreme Court, the essential security interest, and the Swiss Federal Supreme Court...
So the answer is yes?
Yes.
Right.
But not before the district court.
Not before the district court. That is correct. I think they reserved it before the district court. And again, we come back to where it wrapped up before. It was everything in there is on the merits, and they shouldn't get another chance. If they wanted to raise that, they had their opportunity.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. We'll
thank you.
Give Helen 3 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. So just a few points. On colorability, I have just 4 points that I'd like to make. First is just to reiterate that there really can be no doubt in our view, that our immunity arguments were colorable at the time in September 2021, a full 3 years before NextEra 2 came down. You had district court decisions. In NextEra 2, you had a 2.5-hour oral argument, 18 amicus briefs. You spent approximately 10 pages on this particular issue. There was no way that there wasn't ambiguity or uncertainty at that time. Also, as Chief Justice noted, it would create, you said, a difficulty, and I would say it would become untenable if colorability was as high of a standard as DT is suggesting it would be, because foreign sovereigns indeed would feel compelled to have to brief all of their immunity and merits defenses at once in order to avoid this result in the event that the district court not only denied their motion to dismiss on immunity, but found that they really disliked the arguments so much that it would constitute a waiver. And the whole purpose of the PNID in permitting foreign sovereigns to brief immunity before the merits is to avoid the burden of litigation of suit. So if you have to brief them all together, then you're basically doing away with that framework. Third, there was an arguable circuit split at the time, still is, with the Fifth Circuit's Al-Karkhani case that we've briefed in our papers. And finally, on that point, there is no Supreme Court jurisprudence on this. Spain has announced publicly that they are putting in a petition for certiorari. This is not a case where you have concrete circuit court precedent that has been in place for years that is being ignored by a party. Far from it. You have evolving jurisprudence and you have no Supreme Court decision. Second is that even if this court would find that our immunity defenses were not colorable, and again, for all the reasons we think they're more than colorable, then the court abused its discretion by finding that we waived our right to raise any additional merits defenses and to brief them. And we cited several cases in our briefs that I would just urge you to take into consideration, particularly the practical concepts versus Bolivia, where they say sovereigns should be enticed to appear in our courts, and we ought to give them every opportunity to make arguments. In the BG versus Argentina case, which I hesitate to raise given the history, but on this point it wasn't reversed, that's where the district court ordered that there would be additional briefing, even though it was highly skeptical of Argentina's arguments that it had raised. And that was the language that they used. That was after the court denied Argentina's motion to vacate, and there was a cross motion to confirm, and the district court didn't rule on it. And then finally, in Shotsky versus PLO, this court reversed for an abuse of discretion, finding that the sovereign had, instrumentality, or the PLO had actually reserved its jurisdictional objection and shouldn't be found to have waived it, even though it had participated.
Suppose we think the immunity defenses were colorable, but wrong as immunity defenses. So I'm on the point about assignment to the arbitrator or not. Isn't there, to take your point about Indian law seeming to adopt this model of judicial review, but your friend makes a competing argument, like, okay, there was judicial review in Switzerland. There was judicial review in Germany, which are the courts of one of the signatory countries. I mean, who the heck is DDC? This is just secondary enforcement in a country whose background rules per BG just don't presumptively recognize this model.
Well, that's also, and I take your honor's comment about our form non arguments, but that's why also we think that this case should be heard outside of the United States. But quite apart from that, yes, and I'll leave that apart. I think that my DT's counsel's reading of the provision in the bid doesn't accord with its text. It doesn't say what he thinks it says or what he thinks was the motivation behind it. There's no, you can't read that by the text. And I think once again, we go back to the party's intent and the fact that there was de novo review in Germany. That shows that the parties had that, or it's consistent with what I'm saying is the party's intent, because when they enter into an agreement to arbitrate with the ANSA trial rules, they expect that secondary jurisdictions, as well as a primary jurisdiction, is going to have review authority. There's nothing in there, as far as U.S. law is concerned, the fact that you had de novo review at the seat does nothing to help them with a delegation argument, because the Supreme Court has said you look for clear and unmistakable evidence that the party is intended to delegate to the tribunal. That now they're talking about delegation to the seat. There's nothing there. And there is no issue estoppel or issue preclusion in New York Convention cases. There is very limited when you see in the New York Convention.
I don't want to get into preclusion as a basis for affirming. Sure. I'm just trying to think, can we affirm on the ground that Indian law does allow for judicial review on arbitrability, but you got that. You got that twice. And it doesn't compel every enforcement court to redo the same question.
Again, with respect, I would say no, because that's not the question. The question is, did the parties clearly and unmistakably delegate the question of arbitrability to the arbitrators? That is no. And so the fact that a court in Germany, a court in Singapore, a court in Switzerland has looked at it doesn't bear on that question. We did not delegate exclusively to the arbitrators here, and therefore the court itself, the U.S. court, needs to look at it.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.